This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Joy James. She is professor of African Studies at Williams College, well known for writing about American politics and the place of African Americans in American politics. She's interested in a number of things, in the problem of black incarceration, of black leadership. She'll be giving a talk in the MillerCom series this afternoon on the U of I campus at 4. Democracy and Captivity is the main title, which encompasses in the talk encompasses a lot of different things that she is interested in and has written about over the years. Certainly, people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana are welcome. These talks are always open to the public. They're always free and open to anyone who would like to attend. So that's this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. We're also pleased to have her here with us on the program. Over the years, we've had a lot of people in this series, had them on this program as a way of bringing them to a wider audience, not just people who could actually come and hear them speak. We're pleased to have her here. Also, there is a possibility, as always, for people who are listening to call in and ask questions. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. At any point here, certainly people can be involved in the conversation. The only thing we ask is people just try to be brief so that we can get in as many calls as possible, but certainly people are welcome to call. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
Because you are the talk you are giving is the W.E.B. Du Bois lecture, and does and you did write a book. I know now it's not new, but a number of years ago, picking up on or looking at the concept of black leadership and making a reference to the idea of the talented 10th, which is something that people associate apparently with W.E.B. Du Bois. I don't know that he coined that phrase, but but people think about, when they hear that, they think about him.
Right, David. Actually, he popularized the phrase in 1903 with the publication The Souls of Black Folks, which is sort of his primary work that most people are familiar with, and that's taught in universities and colleges across the country. But the term itself was coined or created by Henry B. Morehouse, who is a white philanthropic, in you know, activist of sorts, right, and also a religious man, and the American Baptist Home Missionary Society in the late 1890s. And so what you have after the end of Reconstruction and the reinstitution of the slave codes that become the black codes that will eventually become the Jim Crow that Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and others will struggle against in the 1950s. But what you have at the turn of the century is the resubjugation of so-called freed blacks, right? And so with the imposition of racial supremacy again, with a lack of economic viability because, there, you know, 40 acres and a mule never really materialized, you end up with social unrest. You know, the Klan is growing strongly. Later it would be popularized in Griffin's Birth of a Nation, right? And so to manage the social unrest, and as a counter to Booker T. Washington and his advocacy for industrial training of blacks, you know, the industrial sciences, which would be agricultural labor, domestic science, or domestic work. So again, it's a labor force, but it's subjugated to a dominant culture. At this moment, the American Baptist Home Missionary Society looks at the landscape and says, well, there's a potential for a kind of explosive encounter. We just had a civil war a number of decades earlier that Du Bois notes in Black Reconstruction when he writes that book a number of years later that over 200,000 African Americans fought, right? And so in order to manage crisis, social crisis, racial division, racial oppression, they suggested creating these elite institutions. And so Morehouse, where we know that Martin Luther King went to school, right, and Spike Lee, and it's kind of famous for that, is named after Henry B. Morehouse. So this white Christian attempting to manage a kind of unrest, but actually to argue for black advancement, but gradual advancement. Spelman, which is a sister school, right, which is an elite black women's school where Jeanetta Cole was president a number of years back. Spelman is named after Laura Spelman, who's one of the Rockefellers, right? Hmm. So you have these elite schools proliferating, and here's their ideology. We're going to have a talented 10. This is the top 10%. And we're going to train them in these schools that are going to be like Harvard or Yale or Princeton. In fact, Du Bois has a PhD from Harvard, right? What we want, though, is for these schools to stay in the South because that's where the mass of black people are. So we're not arguing that they shouldn't be in these elite white institutions throughout the country, but politically, to be useful, they have to have a proximity to the majority of the black people, that other 90%. And what they will do is function as a model. Say, you know, here's the elite. We've made it, this elite, then college educated, university educated. And what you're to do is to model our behavior, to accept our interpretations, which are generally liberal, about democratic society and possibilities of, quote, racial uplift. And this way you have a buffer zone. So the Talented Tenth actually is a two-edged coin, or it's a double coin, two-edged sword. I'm messing up my metaphors here, but their function is to serve for racial uplift and integration to a fuller democratic society, but it's also to manage dissent. So they're a buffer zone between the 90% and the rest of white society and its complicity in racial oppression by its indifference to the rise of racist violence and economic exploitation.
So now, and I guess it's also my understanding that initially, while Du Bois embraced the concept, that then later on, he said, "No,
yeah,
wait a minute."
This isn't working.
Yeah.
Well, you know, look, it's a beautiful concept if you accept the idea of political dependency and the need for elite leadership, right? And you also believe that elites inherently will want to serve a greater population rather than serve their own selfish interests, meaning to reproduce themselves as elites. So as Du Bois ages and as he matures, actually, right? So from 1903, when he popularizes this term in the souls of black folk, to, you know, founding the NAACP, co-founding it with others like Ida B. Wells in 1909, to reading, you know, Marxist Communist Manifesto later in his life, to working with trade unionists, whatever, he sees, and he writes about this in his memoirs, that the Talented Tenth didn't deliver on the promise. Maybe the promise that Henry B. Morehouse and the early, liberal elites wanted them to fulfill, maybe that promise, but not the promise to serve the mass of disenfranchised, politically excluded, economically exploited, and racially terrorized black people. And so he begins to write about these disappointments. And actually in the 1950s, when the McCarthy era tries to extend a long arm to, you know, touch Du Bois in a way that it did, say, Paul Robeson and others, and he's threatened with charges of sedition because he's studying about the Soviet Union, he's talking about workers' rights, he's talking about socialism, he writes that it was only radical labor activists, trade unionists, who rallied behind him and probably helped keep him out of jail as a political detainee. It wasn't the Talented Tenth that he had always thought would be sort of the knights that rescue.
Hmm. Who were, and if you would say who was, you put it this way, who was the first class, who was the first graduating class of the Talented Tenth? I mean, who were the...
Okay, that's a big struggle. It's like, I was there, no, I wasn't. okay, so who gets to count? It depends on who's counting, you know. Mm-hmm. But I would say my focus has been a lot on political activism, particularly what's called, quote, radical. And then how do you define that term, right? We could talk about that later if you want to, but people who really served in the way that Du Bois and others thought they should serve, meaning that the buffer zone they provided was not to manage dissent, but to help shape it, to give it a certain kind of coherence, a certain type of focus that would reveal to the nation the ways in which democracy historically was married to captivity, and that captivity focused heavily on the black body, not exclusively. We could talk about the exploitation of children, of white workers, of Native Americans, of Mexican workers, you know, of Chinese indentured laborers. We could go on and on about the U.S.'s racial and economic and gendered problems, right, over the years. But who would count, say, if we went back to the turn of the century at the time that Du Bois and others were starting to be active? I would put a woman in there. I would put Ida B. Wells Barnett, mm-hmm. who for me is fascinating. There's a phrase that some of us use called ancestral mothers or ancestral voices, right? Those activists or intellectuals or artists who sort of passed on to the other side but who leave a legacy, right? And Ida B. Wells is one of them. She's known for her anti-lynching crusades. In 1892, she had close friends and kin. One of them was Thomas Moss, who was the father of her goddaughter. They were lynched in Memphis for opening a people's grocery, which was an economic competition against the local white grocer. And what happened is that at night, plainclothes white detectives, without identifying themselves, came up through the alley. And the men inside who were having a meeting, you know, a business meeting, looked out and saw these armed people and said, wait. And, you know, there was a crossfire, you know. And later on, when the smoke cleared and when those who were injured were noted and so forth, the men inside were arrested and they were later lynched. And so Ida B. Wells did not have the cachet that Du Bois did. I mean, she did not have a PhD from Harvard. Her parents had died in an epidemic years earlier, so she'd been an orphan. She had dropped out of school to start teaching, right, raised younger siblings. But she positioned herself as a, quote, race leader who understood herself to be an intellectual. And so Monroe Trotter, Ida B. Wells, W.B. Du Bois, there's a whole group there who were very active in confronting racial violence and economic exploitation. Now, would somebody like Booker T. Washington be part of the Talented Tenth? I would argue, I'm not sure what I would argue about there. Obviously, Booker T. in his political advocacy did not support the ideas that Du Bois and Ida B. Wells, Monroe Trotter, and even the white missionaries had put forward, in that you needed a cultured elite that understood the importance of the, quote, life of the mind, letters and art and so forth. You didn't need another form of labor, even if they accumulated capital, like by having, you know, farms and whatnot. So, but Booker T. was influential. He was politically savvy, and he was very powerful. He helped to destroy Ida B. Wells' career. So I guess I would say that over a century ago, the ideological differences that we found among the black elites about who gets to count as a talented 10, who gets to count as a real black leader, have carried themselves out into contemporary times. Yeah. And whoever is counting is probably the one who gets to count, which means there are going to be different answers to that question.
Well, if we can jump all the way from there to where we are now, mm-hmm. one of the things that I was interested in having you talk about and reflect on was black leadership today.
Right.
And perhaps put that in, use as a context for talking about it, this very notion that if you can produce a group of people, an elite group, whether they come out of the academy or somewhere else, and I guess initially the idea was that they would come out of the academy, that would be very important, that would be your vanguard of social change, at least as far as the experiences of African Americans are
right.
concerned.
I think I'm in some ways one of the heirs of Du Bois. I mean, a number of people claim to be that. Henry Louis Gates at Harvard, Cornel West, who's left Harvard, of course, with all that controversy, and now at Princeton. And even though we all claim to be heirs of Du Bois or Ida B. Wells and other ancestral figures, We have different interpretations of what is the state of black leadership today. And I think most of your listeners are familiar with the controversies about statements made by Bill Cosby and others. And then Juan Williams has this new book out. And then there's Shelby Steele and Claude Steele. So we span the whole ideological spectrum, just like the rest of America, right? That we have our conservatives, we have our liberals, we have our radicals. Our radical voices will be probably the most marginalized. And in some ways, in a conventional way, some people would say there would be the least effective, but I think not. I think it's actually the radical voices that are not studied so often that reveal, you know, what the crisis is in American democracy and what the problems are. And we'll talk about the need for change, not just in terms of conventional statements or conventional politics.
It seems to me that radicals are always going to get marginalized.
Yeah.
So that would argue that if you want to be successful, you're going to have to position yourself
to
be mainstream.
Yeah, that's what my students always tell me. They're like, can we read something else now? No. And yes. So when you start with the yes part. Yes, that there are clear lines within which you stay if you want conventional success. I mean, you plan your life, your professional life, you plan your career, right, to accumulate a certain kind of currency, you know, which means that you become predictable in some ways, right? That this inability sometimes to distinguish one political party from the other may be about the cautiousness of staying towards some kind of center, which has actually shifted to the right in the last decade. So you always have to watch that. The lines keep moving, you know, in places you may not have predicted they would go or would hope they would go. But the creativity of making an intervention that becomes a disruption of the repetition of just the same old thing over and over again, and the disaffection that people have with electoral politics, with the leaders that were given to, quote, choose from, with electoral theft, you know, particularly if it's a black vote, 1 in 7 black votes are not counted nationwide in terms of presidential elections. There's a study that came out a couple years ago. People tend to focus on what happened in Florida, you know, in 2000 or Ohio in 2004, but across the board, certain under-resourced communities lose electoral power because for whatever reasons, technology or corruption at the polling site. So I'm going to actually make an argument for the radicals, particularly if it's about dealing with racism in the United States. I think that the way in which we think about racism, the way in which we challenge it, has become so incredibly watered down. It's like, you know, it's like we're being spoon-fed this racialized notions of what it means to be civil that refuse to address the problems of the continuity of white supremacy in the United States. And I would argue that academic elites, political elites, economic elites may not be in touch with the majority of people of color who face the worst excesses of racial exclusion.
We are getting close to our midpoint. We have a caller that I want to bring into the conversation. Our guest is Joy James. She's professor of African Studies at Williams College. She is here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk in the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4 o'clock. I want to mention one new work that she's been involved in. I'm assuming this is an edited collection.
Mm-hmm.
That's the title is What Lies Beneath Katrina, Race and the State of the Nation. And it is out just South End Press, and this is now brand new?
It's brand new. Mm-hmm. It came out about a month ago. And actually, this is my idea of radicals' intellectual endeavors. The South End Press is organized by a collective. It's mostly women, I believe. It's a multiracial collective of women. And if you see on the back of the book, they're like read, write, and revolt. And of course, mm-hmm. we can like, again, define these terms, right? But their non-elites, they're radicals, and they put out this incredible anthology where they have voices of people who are from New Orleans, who were abandoned there, people who struggle for the right of return, academics, artists, poets, have all come together, and this becomes a new form of political literacy and voice, right? And it's outside of conventional politics, what people say about their lives, about their struggles, about their abandonment. And I wrote the afterword for that, and, you know, I wrote about the Shoot to Kill edict that was put out for survivors. You know, as we all know now, that the stories of rampant criminality, of rape, of looting, of sniping, of violence, were all exaggerated. But it was an exaggeration that the nation was willing to accept when it was tied to a particular type of body, right? An impoverished body, a black or brown body. And to have a shoot to kill edict over you when you're attempting to survive was, for a number of us, you know, the way in which Du Bois was catalyzed, or Ida B. Wells, by lynchings, you know, at the turn of the century. New Orleans radicalized us who already thought we were radicals. I mean, we were like academic radicals. You got a, like, heavy armchair thing going on and you're in the library. But the shoot to kill edict, you know, was stunning. And on one level, our Wright sense of humor said, well, you should caution all good parents to secure bulletproof vests before they go for Pampers and bottled water and baby formula. But you have the right to survive when you've been abandoned. And you have the right to survive at all. So to criminalize the right of black people to survive, and it was a largely black impoverished population, seemed to be just another continuation of not just racial exclusion, but this abhorrence of a particular type of blackness in the United States, you know, a desire to disappear it or discipline it at any cost.
Let's talk with this caller that we have here, line number one in Champaign.
Hello? Yeah, this is wonderful. God bless you for what you're writing and what you are speaking. I think two open wounds in America, and I'm sure there are others, but the ones that stick out to me today would be one, the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and two, the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. And I do believe if we had radical, talented 10th people like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I know every time we come around to his birthday, people tend to not view him as a radical, talented 10th, but I do, because I was back there in the South, and I know how he was radicalized by the conservatives in the South and even some black ministers in the South. Today, I don't see that radical, talented 10th that in any way comes close to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He spoke out against the Vietnam War, much to the chagrin of President Johnson and other people in this country, including black people, mainstream black people. He was ready to have the poverty march, which caused all kinds of consternation in this country. I could not see him not speaking out radically, vociferously, against the what's going on now in Hurricane Katrina and all up the Gulf Coast with regard to black people and poor people. I am very disheartened about the lack of voices from anyone, including Reverend Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, and specifically people from the academia, about being a radical, talented 10th of the ilk of Ida Wells and W.E.B. Du Bois and Martin Luther King Jr. I'd like for you to comment on that.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. I think they're very important, and you've brought up a number of issues that I, you know, didn't touch on. I agree, King is absolutely pivotal in this discussion, and he's been turned into a national icon and romanticized in a lot of ways. And yes, people remember the speech, the 1963 speech in the March on Washington, that I Have a Dream. But they don't remember other speeches that King gave, you know, because they're not popularized. And his condemnation of the war in Vietnam, and I'm from a military family, so I had a father who fought in Vietnam. And, you know, I think actually that radicalized me as a child, just watching him come back and just see a certain type of disintegration and alienation from returning vets who have been traumatized by either what they've done or what has been done to them. And I think we're definitely going to carry that burden again as we have people returning from the occupation and the war in Iraq and also from Afghanistan. So when King speaks out, you're absolutely right. He loses liberal support. He loses white liberal support because the thing is, right, it's almost like a corridor. I talked about these shifting lines. So if you're a black intellectual or you're a black civic-minded person, it's almost like demarcated. This is what you should talk about, not foreign policy. Now, the irony, David, as we said earlier, is that a very conservative, very pro-war, very pro expansion of empire, you know, however he chooses to define it, president has brought black elites into the State Department to, quote, run a certain kind of foreign policy. But it's a foreign policy that has nothing to do with human rights. It has nothing to do with honest discourse in a democratic society, you know, in terms like, are there weapons of mass destruction or not? Can we just get the truth for, you know, once? And so to what extent there's an autonomous, independent voice that could claim to be radical. And radical means to go to the root. And part of the going to the root is to be truth-telling. It's just the sheer honesty of a human endeavor to live on this planet in cooperation and community with other people. It's the precondition for having civil society, right? And someone like King or even Malcolm X, the later Malcolm X, right, or Fannie Lou Hamer or Ella Baker. I mean, there's scores of people whose names we don't generally think about. We don't call them out as ancestral voices, as people who have wisdom, right?
Yes, right.
And so the erasure or the marginalization of this group shrinks the spectrum. I talked about the spectrum earlier, right? So that the only viable choice is like a two-party choice again. You know, it's, you know, you go in, there's the menu, none of it's healthy. And it's like, well, I'm sorry, this is all we're serving. And so it's like, well, look, I can go home and whip up something else. And I think that's what we have to do. I really think, academics included, that we have to rethink what it means to be engaged in society and not to be a conformist and not to settle for anything that people dish out on your plate and tell you that it's edible when you see incredible amounts of destruction and abandonment unfolding.
Thank you very much.
No, no, thank you for the call. I guess I'm moved again, though, to go back to the question, how it is that you do that, given that for someone who is an academic intellectual, you can pretty much say whatever you want, but for somebody who was running for office, it goes back to my idea before, is that, you know, to be successful, there's this idea that you got to keep yourself to the middle. You know, you can't be too radical. So how do you connect?
Okay, David, what is the definition of success? I mean, if the definition
Well, I would say getting elected would be.
Yeah, but if you think about some of the early elections that happened, you know, during the height of the civil rights movement, 1960s, 1970s, when you had these first black mayors being elected in, you know, Gary, Indiana, or in other cities, you know, in Newark and so forth, they were accountable to a base of non-elite black. I mean, there were elites too, including the superstars, you know, like Harry Belafonte, Ozzie Davis, Ruby Dee, who would, you know, campaign for folks, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, Jesse Jackson got made by non-elite people who wanted change. So now the question becomes, for me, you know, did you get what you paid for? I mean, I hate that sense almost of what I said, because everything then becomes like the marketplace. But did you get what you gave? Was there reciprocity, right? So now we have these crossover candidates, and that's great. And that's supposed to be an evolutionary statement about the United States of America, that it's less racist. Okay. But on another level, maybe what it accepts is what looks like another version of its pristine self or its idealized self. Maybe what it accepts are black voices that are not disquieting, that aren't troubling, that are always reassuring, right? That make you feel that reconciliation is right around the corner. In fact, we already have it, so why even try that hard? So the point is to be non-racist, not anti-racist. To be anti-racist, you have to struggle. I mean, because you haven't gotten there yet. But the celebratory, we've arrived, or, okay, not quite yet, but we'll arrive next week, or we'll arrive after you elect me. Mm-hmm. That's not sellable to me. That's not acceptable. And you can't have dual stories. You can't have multiple narratives. You can't go into impoverished sectors and promise one thing and say one thing, and then go to affluent sectors and say another thing. That's also not truth-telling, and that is not radical. And, you know, I don't think radical has to be that complicated. I just think it has to be honest. And the honesty would be about acknowledging our errors as a nation. It would be about admitting our investment in immoral wars, economic profiteering coming from those wars, the body count disproportionately borne by working class, including white, right? Black, Latino, you know, Asian soldiers, the way in which seeking empire can destabilize a world. And at home, this kind of implosion with the resources funneling elsewhere and the denial about our racial and racist disparities.
I have to ask you about Barack Obama.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I do.
I'm not from the state, you know. So
well,
I'm, not.
I'm just the only I just want to ask in this respect that here we now have someone who is running for president who is a man of color, person of color, and I guess people do get into some arguments about who he is exactly and how it is he represents himself. But I think that a lot of people would there are a lot of people who are excited about his potential. Obviously, it's a long way to go now. Who knows what would happen? What is his significance? What significance do you think it has, the fact that many people of different backgrounds are very excited about this guy and would like to see him be president of the United States?
I think that's important, but to what degree and for whom, I think it becomes a second question. He identifies as black. I don't, you know, fine. You tell me who you are, I'd say fine, yeah, so that's who you are. And so the speculation about who or what he is seems to be, you know, irrelevant in terms of his racial identity marker. The more important thing would be, what does he stand for politically? Is he a reconciliator? Yes, more so than, you know, Bush used the same terminology. I would say so. Is he in opposition to wars that are based on economic profiteering? Yeah. Is that a step up from what we have? Absolutely. Does it deal with the fundamental contradiction of democracy and captivity in the United States? No. We have 2.5 million people incarcerated or detained. The vast majority of them are people of color. They're incarcerated largely for nonviolent crimes in terms of drug offenses. The Sentencing Project, based in Washington, D.C., has issued reports that if you're white, and if you're black, there's a huge disparity, or if you're black and Latino, disparity in terms of policing and incarceration. So that a black person is 8 times more likely to be incarcerated for the same offense as a white person. That you're 4 times more likely to get the death penalty if the victim is white. And that these disparities are almost fixed in our criminal justice system, and they're radiating out, right? That the way in which we've policed a certain captive population has moved beyond the prison walls. You know, for example, if we talked about immigration, right? NPR recently had a report on a detention center outside of Austin, Texas, where whole families now are being detained behind razor wire. And even though, you know, the people, the administrators say, well, they're just ages 5 to 18, the reporters, the public radio reporters said, well, we saw infants, and they're all wearing prison garb. And, you know, now, well, it's pastel blue and green. It's not that, you know, horrible orange. It's like, what are you talking about? You know what I mean? You've put in lockdown children who look at razor wire, and that's supposed to be normal, right? And so there's a penal society that's emerged, that's melded into this democracy where policing and prison is just considered to be acceptable for certain stigmatized bodies, even though it is not the activity itself which marks one as a criminal. So whites will go into rehab for drug use, and blacks will go to prison. When it's almost the same drugs. The Sentencing Project several years ago reported that the majority users now of crack cocaine are white suburbanites. So it's not the offense itself. It's the already stigmatized body. So whether you're coming up from Mexico, right, and you have to be put under razor wire with your eight-month-old baby, and your baby's in this little blue jumpsuit. I mean, what is this, right? But this is our democracy, which is wedded to captivity. If Obama has, and maybe he does, you know, I don't know, statements about what it means to have a growing carceral society amid this democratic endeavor, then he would be a radical in my mind.
How do you, I ask this question knowing maybe that's really far too complicated, how do you disentangle the two things, one being skin color and the other being social class? And the fact that both of those things divide America. And I think that some people would be prepared to argue that, in fact, class is a more significant and less well-acknowledged divider than is race.
Right. And that would be an argument that's been made for decades, mm-hmm. right, among mm-hmm. progressives. I think racism has a lot of currency still, and that absolutely right. You know, we have to talk about economic exploitation and class and the breakdown of labor, the labor movement, right? And the outsourcing of jobs to other nations where people are exploited, you know, horribly, right? And we also have to talk about gender and sexism and what it means to live in the 21st century democracy that has so many problems. But, you know, racism, specifically what I'm talking about is white supremacy, is alive and well, and it filters throughout this society, right? It shapes the way in which we think about class. It shapes the way in which we think about bodies, whether they're white women's bodies or black women's bodies, you know. I'll be specific here with an example, right? Part of what I wrote about, and I've been editing these anthologies, the writings by incarcerated people for the last 8 years. I was a postdoc with Angela Davis in about a decade ago, and through her life story and her work, I sort of, you know, went into this study, theoretical study, and writing about prison incarceration. But what I wrote about in a book called New Abolitionists was neo-slave narratives, right? Going back to these forms of captivity within democracy, but they're racialized. Like, so in the 1670s, that's when the state of Virginia, you know, before then you had, right, poor people, indentured servants from Europe, Native Americans, and Africans, all exploited in labor. And then in the late 17th century, Virginia just said, no, it's just going to be black people, people of African descent. And then, boom, it was on, right? So you get the Constitution when it calls about three-fifth clause, three-fifth of people. There's no racial referent. You know, there's nothing that says black in the Constitution, but you know who you're talking about. You get the 13th Amendment, you know, 1863, is finally codified 1865, in which slavery is actually legal in the United States if you've been duly convicted of a crime. So people who were privately enslaved on plantations after the end of slavery, right, are caught up in the convict prison lease system, where they die at faster rates than they had under slavery on a plantation because they're worked to death. And joint ventures between the state, which arrests them for infractions like not stepping off the sidewalk, as well as infractions like theft and arson and murder, whatever. But they're worked to death in these joint ventures between private industry and the state. And you start to hear these narratives about captivity. It's like, yeah, class is important instead of captivity. And then when you look at these neo-slave narratives, they cut across race. And I just want to say a little more on that stop. When I was at Brown before I went to Williams, I was there for about 5 years, and we were so celebratory. The first black president in Ivy League University. That's when you know you arrived, right? Yeah, well, that's what they say. And, you know, so it was Ruth Simmons, right? And I'm so excited. I write her a little note card, like, welcome to Brown. Like, this is historic. And it is historic. It was historic. And then I turn on the TV, and there she is on 60 Minutes with Mike Wallace. And she's talking about, now she's, at the time, she's president of Smith, and she's on her way to Brown. She's talking about shopping at Saks Fifth Avenue and being followed as a potential shoplifter by the guards and the clerks there. Now, she makes more money than they'll ever, of course, right? But they see the black body, and it doesn't matter that she's affluent, that she's wealthy, that she has a doctorate from Harvard, that she's going to be the first black president of an Ivy League school. I mean, Cornel West has same narratives himself, right, about trying to hail a cab, or when he's in Princeton a number of years ago, driving with this very late model, nice car, and being pulled over and saying, wait, and, you know, the police is like, why are you in this neighborhood at this time? I'm going home, and this is my car, and I'm a full professor at Princeton. And they're like, no, blank, right, is a professor at Princeton. And so they arrest him. So even when you think economic well-being distances you from the stigmatized racial other, yeah, it does. It gives you more buying power. But it doesn't stop the policing mechanism from conflating you with the same body that's been jettisoned as a kind of refuse that you see in the aftermath of Katrina.
We have here as our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Joy James. She's professor of African Studies at Williams College. We'll be giving a talk as part of the MillerCom series this afternoon on the campus, 4 o'clock, talking about, I'm sure, a lot of these same sorts of things. We have a couple of callers, and we'll try to get them in. They can help us by being brief, though. Let's go to Charleston, line 4. Hello?
Yes. Could you define what you mean by democracy?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think democracy is more than the electoral vote. I believe that democracy is full participation in community, and also that even though this is not expressed in our Constitution, right, it's more expressed in UN conventions, that it entails the right to economic decency and well-being. I think that an informed citizenry is a citizenry that has health, that has education, that has economic sustenance, and that understands its value and its participation in the democratic process. A democracy, in my mind, is not really what we have today. It's not a system based in racial or racist exclusion. It's not a system in which money, huge amounts of money, are absolutely necessary to run for the highest public office. And it's not a system in which electoral votes are lost or disappeared in the voting process.
I hear that word continually by even from yourself in this program and all the commentators around the world, the policy of democracy. And there is absolutely on this earth nowhere where that term could be used in the vein of describing or to have the participation that you have just articulated. There is absolutely no place, and to use the word has become to me very offensive when that word is used as if it exists, and it doesn't. It's an idea, just as communism is a grand idea as well, but on this earth we have absolutely no example or living conditions that aspire to either of those entities. And it's just very distressing for me to hear that all the time used in context that somehow describes it as that we have progressed to this point when it's clear to me that we have not. And thank you, David.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point. I mean, that's why I couple democracy with captivity. I believe it is an idea, and it's idealized in a lot of ways, romanticized in a lot of ways, even the Athenian polis, right, that had the senators, well, look at who was excluded and, you know, outside of the public realm and placed in the private realm, right? So women and children and those captives through war who would be made into slaves. But if you believe in evolution, not as sort of pabulum like for a bedtime story, but if you believe in evolutionary struggle as part of a radical political process, then you aim high. And what you're aiming for is full participation and fuller community, right? And that something means to me it's worth keeping the word even as you problematize it because you're keeping an idea.
to Champaign County. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I have the same sort of pessimism that an earlier call expressed, but I am looking around and seeing that the campus seems to be in ferment here. There's this project of talking about race, class, and privilege that just happened on campus here, and it just seems to me that I take some solace from that, that something seems to be stirring. Whether it's going to go past, you know, the climate on campus and Chief Illiniwek, I don't know. But it's good to see that things are boiling a little bit. It struck me earlier when you talked about the Booker T. Washington, I guess you were saying, that he somehow destroyed the career of
Ida B. Wells.
I'd like to hear something specific about that, because I know there's been, you know, infighting amongst all sectors of all movements, et cetera. But I sort of wanted to get you to comment on this critique of leadership that's going around under the guise of recycling the whole idea of victimology. And I'm referring to Juan Williams and that whole bizarre discourse that that says that, you know, people should pull themselves up by their bootstraps. They keep saying it as if it, you know, means anything. I thanks for letting me vent. It's not a well formulated question, but I'm confident you'll do something grand with it. Thank you.
And we have about 5 minutes to
that in. You raised some important points, right? Mm-hmm. So Ida B. Wells was a journalist, and part of what she did to expose lynching and bring it to larger consciousness was to write about it, largely in the black press. Booker T. Washington was so influential because he did stay within the lines, and so he did embed himself in, you know, national politics in terms of going to the White House, offering, like, counseling about the race problem, et cetera, et cetera. What he basically did was destroy the journalistic and the publishing careers of Ida B. Wells and her husband, Ferdinand Barnett, because they opposed him not just about his educational initiatives, which was to keep blacks as non-threatening in terms of the larger economy, non-threatening to whites, so to stay in a service sector mode, which we actually kind of occupy with if you throw in entertainment and basketball and football today, right? But also because of her radicalism about lynching and her outspokenness. She had the Secret Service come visit her because she supported black soldiers that mutinied in Texas against a racist town there. And she was continuously stepping outside of the fold. In fact, W.B. Du Bois pulls away from her and kind of marginalizes her in the NAACP till she eventually drops out. So there are ways in which radicals are not embraced because they're seen as rocking the boat. In terms of Juan Williams, yes, I agree with your assessment. If you dealt with the root problems, go radical to the root, whatever, economic exploitation, increasing police mechanisms that have, in many ways, marred this country, you are not going to be a popular, you know, conversationalist on NPR who has, you know, entree to talk to the president and say, we pray for you. I mean, there's no way that you could be critical about imperialism, war, racism, economic exploitation, environmental degradation, policing of the border, right? The treatment of non-documented workers, and be this popular black person who gets invited to all the parties. So there's an opportunism, like, you know who to bash and you know who to applaud. And if that's considered savvy, that's fine. But it's not sophisticated and it's not honest.
In a minute, can you talk about why there aren't more women in very visible leadership positions?
Well, there's Condoleezza Rice.
Okay.
You mean radical?
Yeah. I mean like radical.
Well, I don't know if that's true that there's not. There's another project that I want to start on in about a year or so, which looks at black women in national office. And I start in 1964 and I end in 2004. And I wasn't trying to be dismissive of Rice, because I want to be clear that some of the jokes levied against her or leveled at her, you know, there's gender involved and there's race in terms of contempt. So I'm not being contemptuous. I'm just focusing on our ideology and our practices, right? Which I find abhorrent. So 1964, you start with Fannie Lou Hamer, and she's so powerful, right, at the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party initiative, right, at the DNC, that President Johnson has to get on TV to get the TV cameras off of her when she's talking about America's failed promise and its lack of honesty. So from 64 to 2004, you see a host of women, Barbara Jordan, Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is representing D.C. but doesn't have, you know, a vote, Maxine Waters from California, Barbara Lee, who did that very historic thing, you know, in opposing, you know, the war, very public. It's just that perhaps black women are just taken for granted as backdrop, and we don't see how much black women have contributed, working with Martin Luther King, working with Malcolm X, working across the board in academia, but also now in national politics for progressive agendas around human rights and a kind of sanity in terms of domestic and foreign policies.
Well, we're going to have to finish here because we've come to the end of the time. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Joy James, professor of African Studies at Williams College. She'll be speaking, I'm sure, on many, touching on many of the same things that we have done here this morning in her talk, Democracy and Captivity. This is the W.E.B. Du Bois Lecture. It's an event in the MillerCom series, also has sponsorship from the African American Studies and Research Program and the Center for African Studies. This afternoon, 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center, open to the public, free. Anybody who was interested should feel welcome to attend. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.